The Tom Woods Show, episode 2004.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here, talking today to Paula Wright. And I'm going to turn things over to her in just a minute to have her describe for you exactly who she is and the kind of work that she's been doing. But I've had a bunch of folks who listen to this podcast send me articles by her, blog posts from her blog, and I have not found a single one of them to be a waste of my time. I've benefited from every single one. She's widely knowledgeable, a very good polemicist, sometimes I'm even too much for myself, but I think she strikes just the right balance of refuting the arguments and smacking down bad guys. And I wanted to, given her status in academia and the fact that she interacts with people all the time who are of a particular ideology, I wanted her to take us on a little tour, more or less, of academic feminism as it stands these days. So, Paula, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here.
I'd like to give you a chance to introduce yourself here. I've read a number of your pieces. In fact, I actually devoted an episode of this program, I have to go back and try and figure out which number it was, to actually going through one of your pieces and just finding it great and amazing. Yeah, I'll dig that out. I must have not told you about that. Yeah. It was because I couldn't reach you right away and I wanted to discuss this thing right away. So I thought, to heck with it, I'll talk about it myself. So that's what I did.
Oh, that'd be great listening.
So first of all, I want to know, we can get maybe a hint of this already, but where you're from, what your background is, and how you got into the middle of so many, you know, some wonderful and some crazy people.
Well, I'm working class, English, from the Northeast, kind of socialist heartland, coal miners, that kind of thing.
Now, when you say Northeast of where?
Well, it's Northeast England, so it's not Scotland. Northumberland, it's about as north as you can go in England and still be in England.
Okay.
And then you get to Scotland. But there's the borders, which is a murky area as well. So at the minute, I'm studying a Masters of Science in Psychology, Evolution and Culture at Brunel, London. And I've been, before that, I was an independent scholar in evolutionary psychology, developing a field which I call Darwinian Gender Studies, which is empirical-based sex and gender studies, not based on feminist theory, but based on biology and evolution.
All right, so let's talk about that. Now, I suppose, without getting into the details of exactly what you study, can I take a wild guess that it has gotten you in trouble with, let's say, the gatekeepers of feminism?
Yeah.
What a surprise.
Well, and I actually got into it because like most people, and I've written an article, Lee Jussum kind of published it on his blog in Psychology Today, and it's called When is a Feminist Not a Feminist? And it kind of detailed kind of my journey from being a feminist into not being a feminist. I'm not particularly an anti-feminist. I'm just not a feminist because a feminist comes with a massive bag of bricks, basically. And I don't really subscribe to all that. But yeah, I began as a kind of one of those reasonable person feminists that I describe in that essay, just thinking that feminism was about equality between the sexes and egalitarianism. And then I started looking at a particular problem. The particular problem was rape, because the rape statistics that we see in the press are horrific. And I just thought, how that can't be. that's like the riddle of the Sphinx. What on earth is going on there? So I started to look at them and I found out that these statistics that are in the press are actually not the statistics that are in the criminal justice system. The feminists are kind of cooking the books, and that actually harms explicitly what they say they want to do, which is they want to get more women to come forward and report sexual assault. But most women think that they're not going to get justice, so they don't. But actually, the statistics show that if you do come forward and you do talk to the police, the conviction rate for rape, certainly in the UK, is 69%, not 7%, which is what everybody thinks. And that's my dissertation at the minute.
That's very, very interesting. So spreading these ideas obviously has the effect of discouraging, because first of all, it can't be a lot of fun to report a rape and then go through the legal ordeal. And if then you're told you've got vanishingly small chance of winning, why would you do it? Of course.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. But on the other hand, who could be against that? You making that statement and that observation, you would think there is be unanimous support for that. Why wouldn't there be?
You would think so. But I came to the conclusion throughout the last 10 years in my studies, because you know, I wanted to falsify feminist premises to make feminism stronger. But I came to the conclusion that feminist theorists, well, feminists, that's feminism, as opposed to just kind of egalitarian women who don't call themselves feminists, they're more invested in patriarchy theory than they are in reality. And in order to, you know, dismantle patriarchy, it always has to be a threat. It always has to be negatively portrayed. And institution, you know, for institutional sexism, racism, all these kinds of things, the institutions all have to be lacking somehow. So they cook the books. Yeah.
Yeah, I get it. I get it. Now, I too have institutional complaints about the regime under which I live, but that doesn't mean that I'm going to just make numbers up or, you know, stuff like that.
Well, they're not making them up, which is interesting. What they're doing is conflating something called the attrition rate with the prosecution rate. And that is quite low. That's about that's anything between, I don't know, in the last 20 years, especially with COVID, kind of something between 2 or maybe 9%. But so is the attrition rate with most other crimes. So there's no real difference in that. You can't point to rape and say there's a terrible kind of something going on here which points to sexism and institutional misogyny and all these kinds of things and not say, well, actually, that's normally distributed across the criminal justice system anyway.
Do you over there have this expression rape culture that we have in the U.S.?
Yes.
And yeah. Is the claim that the UK has a, quote, rape culture?
Yes.
And now
that's feminist, that's dogma.
Okay. Now, I don't quite understand, so I want you to help me, exactly what rape culture could mean. Is it that people are cheering on rape or they don't think rape is particularly important or serious or like what could that mean? I mean, I suppose they would just assume that everybody who's not them is in on it. But I guarantee I favor harsher punishments for rape than any of them do. I guarantee you that. So I don't see how I could be part of it. So what's going on here?
Well, obviously, it's a protean term, isn't it? It changes depending on what they're talking about. And they jump around kind of depending, again, on what they're trying to justify. But let's say kind of a rape culture. Let's say South Africa, India. Let's say Berlin, the fall of Berlin, when the Russians entered Berlin. Their rape statistic there was about 1 in 4, which is the same as feminists from this very famous Koss study, Mary Koss study, claimed was the rape statistic in America. And they generally go back to this quite a lot. Kind of it comes in kind of waves. It goes away when it's falsified and then it comes again. And, you know, that 1 in 4 statistic basically means that you're living, you know, or in Kabul or, you know, Berlin at the fall. When the Russians are coming in, that's a rape culture. That's rape everywhere. And that's certainly not what we're living in, like in the West. We'd be under martial law if rape was that common in the West. And that's using one of the statistics that feminists bring out periodically as well.
I don't know how you get away with this. I don't understand how you can use an expression like this. Maybe what they're trying to get at would be the idea of the star athlete in the town and everybody likes him. And then there's some allegation against him and the town kind of bands together to suppress it because why should we ruin this kid's life and who really knows what happened anyway? And So I think they're probably driving at something like that. And I don't know how common that is.
Well, from an evolutionary perspective, you know, there are two sides of this. There's the, far from living in a patriarchy, you know, the female relatives of a person, a young man or an older man, whatever, who's been accused of rape, are going to side with him. They're going to be derogating the person who's making that. So, I mean, they're both socially, or certainly used to be socially before, you know, the sexual revolution. Before the sexual revolution, you know, if a woman was raped, she'd often get divorced. She'd be ostracized in, you know, in pre-industrial societies. She could be killed, basically. She could be stoned to death for adultery, for being raped. And, you know, those costs are massive. But at the same time, the social costs, when we lived in smaller groups, you know, would be the same for the perpetrator, really. And as communities got bigger and bigger and bigger, it just got harder and harder to be accountable for everybody, to know what everyone's getting up to. So there's two sides to that. And there certainly are cultures around the world, which I would call kind of unreformed patriarchies, which I kind of conceive as that, as they oppress or suppress what's called in evolution female choice. But at the same time, that's what studies have shown, that's not really kind of men doing that. Who suppresses that and kind of interferes with the choices, the marital choices of men and women mostly, are their parents. So again, it's not a patriarchy. Do more men kill more women around the world? Yeah, but more men kill more men around the world as well. It's not a patriarchy. The whole idea of the patriarchy from a feminist perspective just isn't sufficient in any kind of way to describe, you know, complex human phenomena at all.
I wonder what they make of the fact that for a long time, the percentage of women in college has been higher in the U.S. at least than men. It's been 55-45 for a long time.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem possible in a patriarchy.
It would, yeah.
Well, I mean, patriarchy in the tendentious way they define patriarchy, it doesn't seem that should be possible.
Yeah. I mean, in places like Iran, you know, women are, I think, overrepresented in STEM subjects and things like that as well. But I've not really looked into it, but I think it's generally because they're trying to get out, whereas women in the West aren't trying to get out. They can choose what they want to do.
I hadn't thought of that. That's smart. I'm sorry for jumping around so much, but there are so many things I want to cover in so little time. I think maybe, can you tell us what you mean by Darwinian gender studies and how I presume this differs from what we normally hear about under the umbrella of gender studies?
Well, I kind of first got the idea when I first picked up an evolutionary psychology book in about 2002, and it was Robert Wright's The Moral Animal, and everything just dropped into place for me kind of logically. I just thought this is so much more elegant and logical way of looking at, you know, the battle of the sexes and the cooperation of the sexes. It's got much more explanatory power. And so, like I said, I wanted to take feminist premises and apply evolutionary Darwinian tricks to them just to try and, you know, just to falsify them in the first place, to try and find out which ones were more robust than the others and make feminism great again. It took a few years to basically just kind of realize that every feminist premise wasn't really robust at all. There's always got a grain of truth in them, because the feminists tend to look at things from the perspective of how is this happening? You know, how do men, you know, well, at the time, what I thought at the time, how do men get away with rape? Why is the statistic so shocking? Whereas evolutionists look at kind of both why and how. They look kind of deeper into, you know, the psychological kind of history of humans and our evolution and how we've co-evolved together. And I just found far more interesting and logical solutions to the problems that feminists were asking.
Are these ideas that you shared at one time until you looked more deeply? Or, I mean, have you always had the views you've had? Have you had any major changes?
No, well, after I did that, I just had a baby as well. So, and I just finished a degree, a Mickey Mouse degree. I learned a lot about feminism and the degree and Marxism and things like that. But I knew I wanted to go into evolutionary psychology. And I just had a baby. I didn't have any money and I wanted to look after him. So what I did is I set up an online community called Darwinian Gender Studies on Facebook around 2006 or seven. And it was pretty lonely there for a couple of years. And then it kind of took off and I got interest from evolutionary Darwinian scholars. Gad Saad came along, Jeff Miller, anyone who's anyone kind of came through Darwinian gender studies at one point in time. And it became, I always limited the numbers to around about 1,000, because it was never about popularity for me. It was always just about, well, it was my salon. I wasn't at university. I wanted to learn from people and I wanted to hypothesize ideas and discuss them. It was kind of my closed community, if you like. And Claire Lemon came along about 2000, 9, I think. She was there for about 5 years before she left to create Quillette, which is kind of based on the same ideas of what we were doing in Darwinian gender studies.
Hey, everybody, Ol Woods here is going to pause to help make you a better person. And I do that in multiple ways, but one way is to help you absorb a lot more information. I'm always assigning you reading. I'm always saying, got to read this guy's book and that guy's book. And you think, how the heck am I supposed to do all this? But you know that if you did so, you would become a better you, more informed, more confident, more able to strike up conversations with people. And that is where the Blinkist app comes in. Blinkist takes top nonfiction titles, pulls out all the key things you need to know in these books, puts them into text and audio explainers that convey this most important information to you in just 15 minutes. They do this in 27 different nonfiction categories. Now, you can use Blinkist to take some topic you know a lot about and become more knowledgeable, or read some author you love and find out, is this book something I'm going to want to delve into given my limited reading time because Woods keeps assigning me books all the time? But on the other hand, you can also use it for books you know you're going to hate. Like, nobody wants to sit down with Hillary Clinton's book, What Happened, and go through the whole thing. But you might have a morbid curiosity about what she's saying in there. And you can get that information painlessly through Blinkist. And of course, think of how productive that makes your commute. In 15 minutes, you've read the equivalent of an entire book. That's why I've used it when I've been driving. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/Woods to start your free 7-day trial and get 25% off a Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/Woods to get 25% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/Woods. What's it like if you have a disagreement with one of the fundamental tenets of whatever various forms of feminism are out there? Is it, well, here, actually, we think there's something you're not seeing, and so let's look at it closely together and see if we can reach a conclusion? Or is it, let's say, less rational than that?
Well, I do know some rational people who call themselves feminists, and we've managed to stay friends.
Good.
but not very many. You know, I think Kathy Young hates me now because she thinks I've betrayed women.
Well, that's just as well. She's a waste of space, so you're ahead of the game.
Yeah, Christina Hoff Sommers, I still respect her a lot. She was one of the first people who kind of supported me.
Oh, good. I thought you were going to say she was bad. I was going to say, no, I've lost all hope.
She's steadfast. She's always been there.
Good.
Well, they have a lot of power. You know, like people are still, you know, I've been writing about this 15 years and looking into, you know, the... feminists have never hidden what they've done and what they wanted to do, which is to dismantle patriarchy, right? Above and beyond equal rights or women's rights or anything like that. The goal of feminism, all feminisms, is to dismantle patriarchy, which kind of is manifesting now as dismantling Western civilization, the family, everything, you know, or capitalism, cis, hetero, patriarchy, you know, it all comes under now, all comes under the rubric of kind of intersectionalism. And then opposite that, you've got the radical feminists who are in ascendance again now at the minute, because the intersectional feminists have made it clear that they really don't give a shit about women because they care more about trans women than actual women. So the radical feminists are kind of coming up against that and like white knights, you know, to save women when they actually set the fire in the first place, you know, about 30, 40 years ago. And the feminists have more representation in our institutions, in parliament, in academia, in everywhere, than women do. So whenever a feminist says we need more 50-50 representation of women, what they mean is actually we need more feminists. They don't want women who are not feminists. And this is, you know, happening in the UN, happening everywhere. In the EU, they've got this policy called gender mainstreaming, which is not, it's such a ridiculous term, but it's basically feminist, mainlining feminism into politics, into global politics. And it's an official policy. So as far as kind of power, well, they can just ignore me or, you know, brief against me and make it difficult for me to get gigs and things like that. You know, there's a lot of editors, female editors of, you know, big supposedly heterodox magazines that are actually dye-in-the-wool feminists who, you know, see me as an ideological complete enemy. So yeah, just, I mean, the thing is, I'm autistic. I've got Asperger's and I don't really do it for financial reward. I do it because it fascinates me. So I'm not going to stop. It's just, I'm just really interested in it.
Well, I read a piece of yours where you went through the way the media had been with regard to, I think it covered Russiagate a bit. And you sound to me, I mean, you certainly call to mind certain figures in the U.S. who would not be considered to be right-wingers, but who just think something's gone wrong here with people I might have thought 15 years ago were my allies. There's something the matter with these people. I mean, the major news stories they report on are fake. I mean, just demonstrably fake. And they continue to believe false things or pretend to believe false things. And then when it comes to their really ideological side, boy, do they make life miserable for anybody who disagrees with them. It's automatically assumed that they're not even people. They don't even deserve a reputation. So, I mean, so do you think of yourself as one of these, let's say, unhappy liberals who, you know, faced with all this, you think, oh, what a shame what's happened to the left? Or are you the sort of person who says, ah, burn it all down, screw the left? I mean, like, who are you, in other words?
I don't know where I stand politically. I mean, like I said, I grew up in the socialist heartland of, you know.
Yeah.
And I lived through the, in a mining village during the miners' strike in the 80s. And I kind of saw then, you know, that it wasn't for socialism, what socialism did to people who actually chose their families before they chose the party. And I didn't like what I saw, you know, people getting spat on and beaten up in car parks. And, you know, at one point someone was murdered because they got a concrete block thrown off a bridge through their car windshield and things like that. You know, it was more like Northern Ireland, and it was horrific. It was nothing to do with, you know, caring for people. It was absolute, it was just tyranny. It was horrible. So I wasn't very impressed anyway with what I saw, and it didn't seem to kind of chime with what they were saying. So I didn't really think about it for a great deal of time anyway. But I voted Labour just like everybody did up there. We are kind of bred to vote Labour for every election. And like I say, there was a turning point when I was about 30 where I went to university and I discovered logic and empiricism and basically just kind of discovered critical thinking and began to think for myself. And I've always probably think of myself as a classical liberal. You know, I couldn't call myself a conservative anyway, because I do support pro-choice for very, very nuanced reasons. I'm not simply in the feminist camp where it's this should be a right and I don't have to explain to you why it should be a right, or even if it should be a right. I have a very complex position on that. So I couldn't call myself a conservative, but I'm certainly have some leanings to conservatism, but also to liberalism as well. But I'm not a progressive. I'm not in favor of progress just for the sake of it. So, I mean, essentially, under that kind of idea, progressing slowly and thinking about possible unintended consequences, that, you know, classical liberal conservative, just somewhere in that area.
Well, then can you tell us a little something about, and I realize I'm asking a million things, but I'm not in this, you know, and I just want to see what's going on. There's this acronym that's used disparagingly, I think you know where I'm going, against certain types of feminists, TERF. Okay, you know, yeah. So can you tell people what that is? And I noticed that that just substitutes for an argument. They don't even make an argument against such people.
Yeah.
These people are TERFs, so therefore they don't deserve an argument. And it's not even like, by the way, you get the sense that rational argument is really held in, like, let's just say, their top 10 values. But the way these people are treated is just ridiculous. Oh, look at this person's a TERF, and that's it. So it's automatically, everybody knows that there could not conceivably be any good arguments, so we won't even listen. So what is that all about? What's going, and where does that all stand right now?
Well, it's around the different, you know, radical feminists. TERF is trans exclusionary radical feminist, as opposed to intersectional feminism, which accepts men who want to be women and whatever else. Radical feminists don't, but they still do have a weird idea of gender, which is wrong. So neither of them are right. But radical feminists kind of do still believe in, that women are women. And basically, so they can defend women's sex-based rights against something that was passed in about 2004, I think, called the Gender Recognition Act, which is threatening women's sex-based rights, which is allowing men to threaten women's sex-based rights on the basis of their gender identity. I think that's the nub of it, basically. But yeah, the trans kind of activists, wherever they are, certainly really kind of attached to this idea of hysterical femininity, because all over it, I find it quite insulting, really. I'm a very logical woman.
So I don't know how you could figure out a percentage of how significant among feminism in general is the quote-unquote TERF population, but if you had to give a rough reckoning of it, what would you say?
I don't know. I looked at the numbers in feminism generally for an essay in the UK a few years ago, and it didn't really ask people to distinguish between if they were a radical feminist or if they were intersectional feminist. They just said, are you a feminist? And then a lot of the times they'll say, even, you know, they'll cook the books and say, by feminism, we mean people who just want equal rights between the sexes and don't mention patriarchy whatsoever. Because as soon as they mention patriarchy, people go, no, I'm not a feminist. But I think the numbers were, out of the whole population, about 12% of people called themselves feminist. About 7% of them were women. But the thing is about the trans activists, anybody who's critical, you know, most women are not, most people who are critical of trans activism aren't feminists. So they don't fit the definition of TERF, but they get called TERF anyway, because that's their go-to slur. So I get called TERF, even though I'm not a feminist. And I'm not trans-exclusionary either. I just believe in biology. So yeah, it's none of it's rational. You know, don't go there for rationality.
Yeah, you know, I wonder though, I mean, there's I'm sure a fairly substantial amount of scholarly work, some of it of greater merit than others, but on the subject of transgender and all this, because we constantly hear things like there are X number of genders, or there are, you know, certainly more than two, and then other people argue there are only two genders, and then this, and then other people, it's clear that they actually mean sex rather than gender.
Yeah.
And each side says the science supports me.
Yeah, that's the kind of biggest mistake, I think. Well, one of the biggest mistakes that radical feminism, I'll call that traditional feminism in the 70s, did, was that they just accepted this term gender, not realizing how it was going to twist everything, you know, 30, 40 years later to actually not mean sex, to just mean anything. So now you've got gender mainstreaming in the EU, and it doesn't represent women. It represents intersectional feminists who could be men who identify as women. The whole kind of gender thing is a disaster, really. It's a textbook example of unintended consequences of just feminists coming up with an idea that they think is great. It's not tested, but, you know, it kind of goes against the grain and everybody adopts it within their holistic academic groups, and it becomes dogma. And, you know, then 30 years later, it's kind of people get knocks on their door from police by if they assert that a trans woman is actually not a woman. It's insane.
Do you want to go into academia?
Do I want to now? No. I've spent 20 years wanting to do that. You know, that's always been my trajectory of kind of, well, my son's been growing up. I've been preparing myself to enter academia and do a PhD. And now I'm like, finally got, you know, funding to go and do masters. And I don't think so. I mean, there are still some absolutely fantastic people in, certainly in evolutionary psychology is becoming woke, unfortunately. So yeah, I think my academic journey will stop after this, because I don't think I'll have the freedom to write about what I want to write, or, you know, just test the ideas that I want to test.
What are the kinds of things you think you can make a good case for that you wouldn't be allowed to make a case for?
Well, I'm interested in female intersexual competition, which is the way women compete with each other, which manifests in very different ways to the way men do. And as our culture's become much more feminized over the last 50 years, since the 70s, even men are kind of adopting these kind of relational, aggressive, and social media absolutely thrives on relational aggression. It's built, you know, to for narcissists, basically, to just bully people from afar. And that's what cancel culture is, you know. But is cancel culture actually what we're seeing, a manifestation of the feminization of female society, the feminization of our society in general? We're seeing more underhand kind of strategies of competition coming out everywhere. You know, the way truth isn't really truth anymore, or, you know, logic is somehow kind of not really respected, or critical thinking is masculine, and so, even though it's not, you know. And I think the more women have come into positions of power in our society, and certainly it's been escalated by policies that put women into a post, whether they're good at the role or not, that's not going to be very good. That's another unintended consequence that's going to blow up in our faces. So just seeing how, you know, female aggression under the guise of, I don't know, equality, under the guise of social justice, under the guise of all these nice words, but actually it's really brutal, and you're not allowed, it's totalitarian completely. You're not allowed to disagree with it. You know, just like there are female, I wouldn't say matriarchies in nature, but there are matrilineal kind of species where, you know, the top dog or the top person is a female. And in those cultures, in those animal cultures, they're not, you know, socialist wonderlands. They are hideous tyrannies, murderous tyrannies, because hierarchies, you're born into a hierarchy, and there's no way to actually get yourself, there's no meritocracy in female hierarchies. You have to leave and go live somewhere else if you want to travel up a female hierarchy in nature. And I think that's the same in human female nature as well.
All right, let me just put it this way. If I were to, and again, I realize that there are lots of different kinds of feminists these days. And I know that there are some people who try to cling to like equality feminism. And so, look, all we want is just plain old egalitarianism. And then there's difference feminism that recognizes that men and women are different, but we still want blah, blah, blah. I know there are a lot of different, okay. But let's say if we could somehow mush them all together, what exactly do they want? Because I find that people who are, let's say, on the right wing, have finite goals. Mm. I want to accomplish this thing. You know, once my taxes are down to 15%, I'll be happy, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. I don't get the sense that there would ever be a moment at which they'd say, feminism would say, finally, society is the way we want it. Or would there? What is the goal? And is the problem that it's an unachievable goal, or
yes,
or what?
Well, the whole concept, all of them, this is my, just looking at the data, the individual people are going to disagree with this, but this is what the feminist literature says, okay? All feminisms, the primary goal is to dismantle patriarchy. And even though radical feminists and intersectional feminists and trans activists hate each other, they're still all aligned on that goal. Most women, most people who are egalitarians don't give a shit about patriarchy. They don't want to live in a female world, or, you know, in a kibbutz. They want their petrol to be a reasonable price, and they want to just be able to get to work and spend time with their families and go on holiday a couple of times a year. It's that really, really simple goals. And that's nothing to do with changing the world. It's just about minding their own business. But the whole kind of feminist project is about, well, it's a totalitarian project. It's about putting people in a position that they don't want to be and telling them that it's better for them from what they used to have. But they're not listening to anybody. Not actually, it's not democratic.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It doesn't strike me that not just feminism, but a lot of fashionable, you know, academic speak and academic groupthink is, what could be more obvious than how elitist it is? That they could not care less about the lived experience of people who are not as privileged as they are. And boy, do they love using that word privilege.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah,
it applies to them. Imagine being able to spend most of your time writing papers about total BS and talking about BS with your BS friends, and not realizing that that is the height of privilege. You realize how most people had to support themselves throughout history? It wasn't by doing that.
Yeah.
And yet, meanwhile, they have nothing but contempt for the lived experience of the average woman. I mean, really nothing. Because a lot of these women, because they don't have the same worldview, they just think of them as hopeless. It's the same thing the 60s radicals, they felt like they were defending the American working class. And then they found the American working class just had totally different values from them, and it enraged them. Oh, so somebody wants to read your stuff. Obviously, your blog is the place to do it.
Yeah. Or there's my Twitter, which has a link tree thing on it, which has got links to all of my blog. It's got links to my academic profile. It's got links to studies. You can take part in the studies that I'm currently having. Yeah.
Okay.
My Twitter is probably the hub.
Okay. So I'll link to everything. The show notes page will be tomwoods.com/2004. I'll link to everything. I'll link to your Twitter, link to your blog. I'll put that link tree thing up. I'll link to your, why not link to your link tree also? Because holy cow, I've seen a lot of people with these, but they're not using it as effectively as you are, because wow, do you have a lot of different things on here. You're actually four times more interesting. You see how precise I am? Four times more interesting than I thought you were before we started this conversation. So definitely check out tomwoods.com/2004. to find out more about Paula Wright and what she's up to. I am very happy and have had no regrets as a follower of yours on Twitter, and I'm quite certain that my folks listening will feel the same way. So, I mean, I apologize, being a little bit kind of erratic and all over the place, but it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like if my favorite singer was in the room, I would have a million questions I'd want to ask, and none of them have anything to do with the previous one, and they would just be coming out as I'm thinking of them, because I just get so little opportunity to do that. And likewise, I don't really get an opportunity to talk to somebody who is as steeped in, you know, the ideology of feminism as you are, who would actually be willing to talk to me. You know, so it's like, okay, this is, I've got to just throw all these questions out before I forget them. So I appreciate you letting me do that. And
cool.
As I say, I hope people will follow you and check you out. You're doing really worthwhile stuff.
Okay, cool. Well, thank you.
All right, folks, remember, if you like and appreciate what goes on here at the Tom Woods Show, you're going to be like a kid in a candy store in the Tom Woods Show Elite, which is the group for the cream of the crop, the folks who listen to the show and help support me through the Supporting Listeners program. And you get so many goodies in return for this, not just membership in that group. It's so many goodies. It's almost an embarrassment, really. You know, you're going to be red-faced when you see all the things coming your way as my thank you for supporting the show. Get the details over at supportinglisteners.com. I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.